Cool. Well, good morning and welcome to this Unplugged session. Thanks everyone for coming out. How many people here have ever seen me do an Unplugged session before? I know a few people have. Three people. Good. Okay. Well, for people that have never seen it before and have no idea what's going to happen, basically, this is the last and one and only slide I have. We're done with the slide presentation part of the talk. Instead, basically, the way the Unplugged session usually works is it's sort of up to you. So we're going to kind of construct a talk on the fly over the next 65, 70 minutes. And basically, what I typically do is use this notepad here to ask questions at the beginning, try to get as many questions as possible on any topic is fair game, and we'll write up, try to get at least 15 or 20 questions, and then basically I'll kind of put a talk together on the fly and try to answer as many of those questions in kind of some logical order as I can. So it's pretty much up to you as to kind of what we talk about, what we cover. If you don't answer any or ask any questions, then we're just going to stare at each other for the next hour. And we have some helpers that have offered to do some dance moves for you. So please do ask questions. To help incent questions, we have red shirts being handed out. So the first 20 questions people ask, you each get a free red shirt. With that, I'm going to open it up to the floor. Question there. Okay, sure.
And also what we do with the current food, current civilized food.
Okay.
What's the future of XAML?
Why do that and XAML? Okay. Okay, what is the fox in the video that we just saw? But okay, we will work on that one. You get a shirt for that, though. Okay. Good. It's good there's no controversial questions today. That's great. Yeah.
I heard that setup projects are being removed from Visual Studio 11, and I want to know what's the best way to handle setups, also with Team Foundation, using the build services.
What Great. Did you give your wife for Valentine?
Yeah, no. Okay.
Are we going to see features of Visual Studio Ultimate in lower versions?
Question?
Guidance automation toolkit and builder feature will be not supported in Visual Studio 11. And what's next on this topic for Microsoft in the future?
This is the patterns and practices.
Guidance automation toolkit. In Studio 11 is no more supported.
That's a good question. I don't know the answer, but I'll put it down the list and we can talk about it. Yeah, question, second row.
What's Microsoft's view on cross-platform applications?
Okay.
Yeah. Is there any plan for Windows Azure to select the number of resources to use automatically?
Okay.
Bringing in the clouds or cloud services or Azure in existing environments is often a challenge. What's your take on how to convince people, management, about issues like privacy and the safety of their data?
Good question. Next one.
But on the screens, the issue I see is that in the end, your offline or online application has to do input validation. You call a service to put it in a database, and since the client is running on most of the time on JavaScript, how can we eliminate the fact that we need to redevelop the same validation rules and maybe complex validation rules? Two times.
Good question.
Okay. I also have a question concerning Silverlight applications and Metro applications towards the other mobile platforms like Android. What's the strategic point of Microsoft in that?
Okay.
Yesterday we saw a presentation about Azure and the cloud. So I was wondering, what about security and regarding to the privacy of all your data stored over there? Maybe involvement of government and other agencies that want to get to your data, etc.
Oh, sorry, you said about other agencies?
Well, I mean other instances, I don't know. Maybe, yeah, security, yeah. Mm.
So how to, so you just understand how to protect?
How to protect and what? How do you do that? And okay. Can you guarantee this?
Okay, yeah. Security. Okay.
Why are you running a test version of Windows 7?
Why am I running this version of Windows for testing purposes only, apparently. You noticed down there, yeah.
Hello. What's the view of Microsoft about micro framework?
Okay.
Related to the previous question, the Azure instance was a non-genuine Windows copy. If you remote desktop into it, can you explain why?
That's a good story. Yeah.
Can
most
we
days it's genuine, but some days it's not.
Can we expect other front ends for light switch, like, for example, HTML5?
Cool. When do I sleep? We do two more questions, then I'll start answering some. How about? Sure.
Is Microsoft planning a MVVM framework that's more usable? A framework from Microsoft itself?
Why does your current MVVM framework suck? No.
In other words, yes.
Sure, okay, yeah. One more question, and then we'll start answering them.
In SQL Server Azure, why is it not possible to create stored procedure in C#? And it's not possible.
In SQL Azure or SQL Server?
In SQL Server, in Azure. SQL
okay.
Azure.
Yeah, I was going to say, I think you can actually. Sure, CLR Sprox with SQL Azure. Okay. Great. Okay, so this is a good list of questions. We're going to let you, this is actually a great list of questions. Rather than just spend the next 50 minutes letting you keep answering questions and then running out of time, what I'm going to do here is quickly spend 30 seconds rearranging them into some order. And then I'm going to kind of go through the different topics. What I'd love to do, though, is ask questions along the way. So feel free to keep asking questions. But what I'm going to do is take this initial batch and try to organize them in some order so that instead of bouncing around back and forth between them, I can hit a couple of them in one go. So let's do... a couple of Windows Azure ones here. Couple. Are there any more Azure questions? Put miscellaneous here at the end. Okay, so we got some Silverlight XAML ones, we got some Azure ones, we have some client development ones, micro framework. We'll move that down a little bit. Okay. Oops, look at that one up there. How's that look? Look like an okay order. So we got XAML, we got some Azure, we'll do some client, cross-plat ones, we'll do some VS ones, Coplex GitHub, micro framework, and then miscellaneous. But again, feel free to ask questions along the way. Ideally, these are kind of broken up into some sections. So if you have a client question, first and third section would be a good place to put it. If you got an Azure server question, the second section is a good place. You got a VS question, the fourth place. So, but if you feel free to ask questions throughout the way. So First set of questions were around Silverlight, XAML, reusing existing XAML. What's the plan there? Well, Silverlight 5 just shipped in end of November, beginning of December, which is a pretty major update in terms of the Silverlight stack and technology. There's a ton of new features, ton of new capabilities. It supports all the same browsers, all the same operating systems it does today. I think it's a really great release. I'm not actually on the Silverlight team anymore. Unfortunately, when I moved to Azure, the client team, I basically became server-only focused because I took on a bunch of extra stuff. So I can't talk directly around the Silverlight roadmap because it's not actually my team anymore, so I got to be a little careful in terms of kind of what I promise in terms of features because someone else has to deliver them. In general, I'd say, the good thing is Silverlight 5 just came out, and one of the things we did as part of that release is, since a lot of people were asking, like, hey, is my code going to work? How long is my code going to work? We actually published a 10-year support policy with Silverlight 5. So you know for a minimum of 10 years from December that it's fully supported on all the platforms and all the browsers that it's supported today. So from an immediate question of, hey, what about my existing code? Your existing code's safe and it's going to continue to work just fine. One of the questions, that a lot of people were asking, what's the cross-platform story? How do we see XAML? How do we see HTML? How do we see different mobile devices in terms of targeting that from an architecture perspective? In general, I'd say, one of the things that we're focusing more on is how do we use XAML for kind of enabling the richest possible experiences, as opposed to necessarily saying cross-broad plat. Mostly because we're seeing kind of a broad proliferation of different devices out there, and our ability to kind of get a runtime installed on every iOS device, every Android device, every TV and other devices that are coming out there is hard. It's limited just because there's too many platforms for anyone to get everyone out there. Flash has run into a similar issue. And so I'd say the last sort of year we spent a lot of time focusing on how do we enable XAML on a broader set of devices, and how do we make those devices as rich as possible? And so, one of the things that we've kind of announced in the last year has been some Windows 8, and I think there's some sessions here at the conference that talked about building Metro apps for Windows 8. And one of the things that we focused on with that is how do we actually take XAML and enable you to build great Metro Windows 8 apps. We've done similar things with Windows Phone, we're supporting XAML and other devices and other form factors as well. And so a lot of kind of our investment going forward, I think you'll see us, rather than be incredibly broad in terms of cross-plat, focused more on what we think are kind of high-volume platforms where we think we can kind of differentiate and provide some unique value. So Silverlight continues to still be supported in the browser, I don't think we have any plans now to take XAML to Android directly with a supported runtime that we support. And for policy reasons, we can't take it to iOS because it's not allowed through the App Store. So that's kind of the main focus of the XAML team right now has been kind of how do we provide instead the richest possible experiences on the devices we can reach and make sure that you can kind of build those types of apps. In terms of reuse of existing XAML code, the good news is it's kind of the XAML stack is a kind of core suite of technologies. And in particular, one of the things we showed at the Build conference in September, and you'll see even more when the beta comes out shortly at Windows 8, we have focused a lot in how do we kind of reuse XAML assets and XAML code across the different XAML platforms, whether that's Windows 8, whether that's Windows Phone, whether that's Silverlight running in a browser, and to some extent also WPF on the desktop. Although WPF on the desktop supports much more because it kind of supports a full windowed environment, whereas the other platforms tend to be more single screen Metro app, or in some cases single screen or single window frame, if you will, types apps. And so in general, you should see the ability to kind of reuse your XAML assets and your XAML code pretty easily across the different platforms. Hopefully you'll be able to build really great apps across multiple devices using it. So that's kind of a little bit in terms of the first two questions. But at the same time as we're investing in how can you build really great Metro apps, how can you build really great phone apps, know that your existing apps that you're deploying through the browser with Silverlight are also going to continue to be supported for the next decade or more. And with the Silverlight 5 release that just came out a few months ago, I think you'll find a ton of new features, a ton of new capabilities, and the tooling improvements that are coming as part of ES11 make that hopefully even richer in order to program against. So that's a little bit on the first section. Actually, you know what? Rather than go to Azure, why don't we do this section next and then do Azure because it's sort of related. A couple questions around. So, okay, so what is Microsoft's view around cross-platform apps in general? In general, I'd say, obviously, we support Silverlight in the desktop browsers for both Windows and Mac across multiple different browser types. In general, in terms of, as I kind of mentioned, I think one of the things that has changed in the last couple of years is just the wide variety of different devices out there, whether they're cell phones, whether they're tablets, whether they're TVs. And so I would say that in general, if you want to build the richest possible app, you're going to target app platforms, and that's what we kind of think of as apps. If you want the broadest possible reach, we do think browsers and HTML and JavaScript will give you the largest reach, the same way they always have. And as that kind of stack gets richer, there's going to be more things that you can do with it. And so I'd say if you want to reach the broadest possible platforms and the broadest possible form factors, that's probably the place to invest in. And at the same time, if you want to have the best reach or the best richness, you're going to want to try to build an app that's tailored to the different types of devices. From an architecture perspective, what I'd recommend is sort of, if you were in my talk yesterday on NBC4, is kind of architect your app so that on the server side, you can expose web APIs. So that your functionality of your kind of core app logic you can expose and you can call from any type of app target, whether it's XAML, whether it's HTML, whether it's Cocoa with iOS, whether it's Android with Java, and sort of architect your apps so that you'd expose those, and then basically build your front ends against that. And that front end might be ASP.NET, MVC, or web forms, calling web APIs directly from, say, jQuery, again, or it could be a XAML stack, or it could be an app specific to the overall platform that you're calling it from. So that's probably how I'd recommend architecting the app if you want maximum cross-platform reach. And I think you'll find with the web API work that we're doing in NBC4, not only one of the things I didn't mention yesterday in my NBC4 talk, but I should mention is that with a final release, we're also going to do pretty rich OAuth integration within that stack. So that you can use standard OAuth security tokens, again, from any client-side framework in order to actually lock down and provide access control to those web APIs. And again, you can also call those same web APIs really cleanly from jQuery or any JavaScript framework that you want, in addition to obviously C#, VB, Java, Objective-C, or whatever other language you want. But I'd probably implement the back end using that kind of web API layer. On the client side, two other things that you're going to see us invest pretty heavily in going forward with ASP.NET. One is building mobile web apps. And I demoed that also yesterday at my NBC4 talk. And so we're embracing jQuery mobile, and we'll ship that built into NBC4 so that you can build kind of truly mobile front ends that work across multiple form factors, in particular phones and tablets and touch devices. We're also investing in a framework called Knockout that Steve Sanderson did some talks on yesterday. It's open source, so it does work with any back end. Steve happens to be on the ASP.NET team, and we're investing pretty heavily in making sure that that provides a really nice framework that integrates cleanly with our back end. And it does provide a model view, view model framework that works in any browser. And it's a fairly lightweight framework, so you can use it in addition to jQuery or in addition to other templating libraries if you want. I think it's something like 6 or 7K of JavaScript in terms of total size. So it's fairly lightweight, you're going to see us kind of invest in that in terms of enabling you to build kind of maximum reach cross-platform apps. And I think one of the things that Steve showed yesterday was running single-page apps using ASP.NET MVC in the back end, using web API, using Knockout, and he was running it both in the browser, and then he also, just for demo purposes, he had an iOS iPad app that he'd actually natively installed, and he was showing offline support and how to synchronize data back and forth with a single code base backed with ASP.NET on the back end. So that's another option that you can do, and that's something we're investing in. Related to that, someone asked questions about input validation and generally how do you handle data synchronization between the client and the back end. One of the things that we're doing as part of ASP.NET going forward, and it's kind of related to that knockout and the web API work, is a framework we call upshot.js. And it basically, on the back end, shares kind of the same framework that we used for RIA services. And it basically allows you to kind of construct a data model on the back end that you can expose through REST, through web APIs to any client type. So it doesn't have to be to a JavaScript. It could be to an iOS app that's native. It could be to a Windows app that's native. But one of the things it does as part of this framework is it uses REST and it uses OData and it uses the web API work I demoed yesterday. And it basically provides change tracking and validation metadata flowing to a client. And so the benefit there is you can actually build a single entity framework based domain model. You can add validation rules declaratively, and those validation rules can flow automatically to the client, and you can get change tracking support between the data that you're working with on the client and the server. So it makes it much easier for you to go ahead and build kind of much richer apps that can optionally work offline. And Steve's talk yesterday showed a little bit of that in action, and I think you'll see that from a directional perspective going forward is something that we're investing in with ASP.NET quite a bit. In terms of related to other front ends for Lightswitch, I don't think right now we have any other plans that we've talked about. Obviously something we'll probably look at in terms of adding additional options. In general, I'd say the input validation and the overall kind of metadata-based approach that we're doing with Web API, that we're doing with Upshot built on it specifically, will enable kind of higher level kind of tooling in terms of allowing you to kind of get out of having to control each pixel and program against each pixel, and instead for line of business apps, allow you to focus on your data, focus on your business objects, and then surface them to a variety of form factors. And so we're kind of investing on the server side and the framework side in that kind of plumbing. And I wouldn't be surprised in the years ahead that we add better tooling for that inside Visual Studio as well. But I can't speak specifically to that team in terms of the plans there just yet. Other things in terms of what happens if you want to run .NET code natively on, say, Android or natively on iOS devices. As I mentioned, we don't currently have plans, at least that I'm aware of, to port the CLR that we ship on those devices, both for policy reasons and just from a priority perspective. However, one thing, many people have used Zimian's, I'm blanking on the name, MonoTouch and MonoDroid. Anyone use that? A few people have. That's something to look at if you're not familiar with. It's a pretty cool set of tools. It's built by a third party. But basically, they allow you to write business logic and general classes using the .NET base class library. And then you can basically build customized front ends using iOS and Android in their native toolkits. But you can basically write all of your client UI logic using C#, and then compile that down. And then you can actually install it as native apps inside the iOS as well as the Android App Store. That isn't a kind of write once, run everywhere strategy, because you do end up having to build separate UIs for iOS and for Android, but it does allow you to reuse your business logic and allows you to kind of use .NET and specifically C# as a language across your entire client application. And again, I would probably architect your app logic so that wherever possible it's sitting behind web APIs inside ASP.NET. And then you can basically have a fully .NET stack across all platforms, whether it's Windows 8 with Metro apps with XAML and C# and VB, or whether it's with MonoTouch or MonoDroid on top of iOS and Android. So if you want pure .NET client and server, that does give you maximum reach. And then if you want to have kind of a single code base that works everywhere, you know, my recommendation would be to look at implementing not only your web API backend in ASP.NET, but also take advantage on the UI front with some of the things that were coming out with MVC 4 and beyond, with things like Knockout, things like jQuery Mobile, and Upshot. Questions on those two sections I didn't get? Sorry, yeah.
Will WinRT come to the Windows Phone in the future?
Yeah, so the question is, will the Windows Runtime or the Windows RT, which is the new Windows 8 API surface, the question is, will it come to the phone? I'm not on the Windows client team or the Windows Phone team, so unfortunately I can't answer that. So I don't think we've announced anything is probably the answer, and I have to defer to those teams to kind of answer that specifically. I can say Windows Azure works great for Windows Phone. It works great for Windows 8 apps, so I can't answer that. But I'll have to defer the specific API service on the client for those. I think there are some blog posts that the Windows Phone team's done recently around their next release. And so I kind of encourage you to kind of look, go to their blog, and I think they have a little bit more details. And likewise, there's the Windows 8 blog that I highly recommend subscribing to that has a lot more details as well.
Today we saw a nice talk about MVC 4, so especially with the Knockout and the history and the Upshot JS.
Yep.
My question is, when will it be released?
Good question. Yeah, so the question is sort of, I think you're referring to Steve Sanderson's MVC 4 talk, where he was showing building kind of rich client apps using Knockout, Upshot, and some of the history work. And the question is sort of, so when is this going to be released? The beta of MVC 4 will be released. What day is it today? Today's Wednesday, right? It'll be released tomorrow, we hope. Tomorrow, Redmond time. And so that might translate into early morning Friday, Belgium time, depending on when the team pushes the button. But the plan is basically hopefully to release it tomorrow or Friday, the beta. The beta does have, I believe, all the bits that Steve demoed yesterday. It also has all the bits that I demoed yesterday as well in my talk. And it works on VS 2010 and with .NET 4. And so the good news is you can actually start doing a lot of those things today and take full advantage of them. And in fact, the migrations feature that I demoed yesterday, that actually shipped the RTM version of that. So the released final version of it actually shipped a couple days ago. And so you can actually use that within any ASP.NET project or any .NET project for that matter. And that's actually now kind of a locked API feature set that you can just go ahead and use. So the beta of all the client pieces and the beta of the other pieces I demoed, like the bundling, mobile support, and the web API support, that'll be in beta later this week. In terms of the final release, we haven't announced a final release yet, date for that. A lot of it will depend on the feedback we get over the next couple weeks. But I expect sometime this summer is probably when we'll ship MVC 4. It's not tied to Windows 8. It's not tied to VS 11. And so the .NET 4 VS 10 version will basically ship when we think it's ready. And my guess is it'll be a couple more months since post the beta just to make sure we can incorporate feedback. But my guess is we'll probably have like a release candidate later this spring, and then probably ship it early this summer. So yeah, good question. I'll just repeat it since I heard it. Question is, can you go live with a beta of MVC 4 that's shipping this week? And the answer is yes. It does support a go live license. It's still a little bit, you got to be careful. It's beta. But yeah, it will have a go live license. Yeah. The question is, are there any people left on the Silverlight and WPF teams? Yes, there's definitely people left on the Silverlight WPF teams. What I'd say is in general, the way the team has always been structured, even going back several years, it's been a XAML-focused team. And so we didn't have, for the last 2 years, 2 or 3 years, we didn't actually have a WPF Silverlight team. We kind of had one XAML team. And so there's a lot of people on the XAML team. Which projects they kind of focus on depends a little bit in terms of the release schedule. But even in the last 2 years, we've often shipped one release, moved a lot of people onto another release, and then after that release, moved them to back on the other quote unquote product, but it's one common code base. And yeah, there are a lot of people working on it. So any other questions on the client section before we move on to the Azure parts? We can always come back and do more client questions, but good question. So the question is, will there be tooling to generate the view models on the client side for JavaScript? So say, for example, you're using Knockout, like Steve showed, or using the web, you're using Upshot. Will there be kind of tooling to actually kind of design the views that bind against that? There won't be in the next couple months. I expect at some point there will be more tooling to support that directly. I believe we'll probably have scaffolding support, so you can point to a view model and it will generate for you the appropriate view templates that are data bound against it. But then you'd go in and you tweak and customize it with code as opposed to a visual designer. So I do think we will have scaffolding support. We won't for MVC 4 have a GUI specifically for Knockout views. In general, that's mostly because the way typically we see people working with rich client-side JavaScript and with HTML typically doesn't always lend itself well to a WYSIWYG designer, mostly because the designers typically generate more weight in terms of page size or in terms of JavaScript size that when you're downloading across the internet can sometimes be an issue. If you look at, say, the Blend designer for HTML that we're shipping for Windows 8, that's slightly different because you're generating JavaScript that's going to be pulled locally off disk. And so, having some of the transitions and some of the animation work that it provides doesn't really impact you negatively. In fact, it helps you tremendously. But if you're downloading it on, say, a phone over the internet, every extra kilobyte in size of JavaScript or HTML payload starts to impact you. And so, in general, we've tried with MVC to allow you to use any framework and wherever possible kind of optimize around bandwidth and performance load time, which is why we haven't in the past built WYSIWYG designers for it. Instead, we focused more on scaffolding to get you started and then provide an easy way for you to go in and tweak. So, moving on to some server questions here. How to convince management to support the cloud? This is a good question. It's a question I get asked a lot, actually, which is, how do you convince your bosses, hey, this Azure thing looks interesting, or frankly, any cloud-based thing looks interesting? In general, I'd say a lot of it depends on your business, and a lot of it depends on your scenarios. And I was talking to a few people yesterday, and they said, how do I, should I think about Azure and I think about the cloud as taking my existing apps and moving them to it? And my kind of answer to them was, actually, I wouldn't think of the cloud as a way to simply migrate your existing apps and your existing infrastructure to our data centers. You can do that, but in general, I don't think that's the biggest return on investment that you can get, mostly because whenever you move something from A to B, it's a lot of work. And at the end of the day, if you do it successfully, often all you've done is implemented the same functionality in a different way. And there's not as much immediate return on investment in terms of doing that. The thing I would recommend if you want to try to convince someone to move to the cloud is looking at how do you take your existing apps and how do you take your existing workloads and how do you extend them in unique ways. And that ends up being kind of much more powerful in terms of an argument for why you should do it. And once you've actually done it, generally what people will find is, wow, we're getting a lot of value out of it and they're excited, as opposed to, hey, the app still works the way it did, but you just spent 6 months porting it. Generally I would recommend when you're talking to, say, someone like management, look at how do you extend to the cloud as opposed to necessarily how do you just replace it. And then over time you can replace things as well. In terms of some of the kind of, I'd say, the most immediate return on investments that you can get for the cloud kind of fall into a couple of different buckets. One is probably mobile enablement. This is something that a lot of companies that have existing apps that run in their, on corporate environments want some ability to say, hey, I want my employees to be able to look up information on their phone. I want to be able to have touch-based apps that they can take on the road. And I want to provide some access to data that's stored inside existing databases or inside existing systems. And that might not be complete access. It might just be to a subset of the information. And obviously, you want to lock that down typically so that you don't just open it up. I was kind of laughing yesterday. One of the scenarios people picked was medical patient data to expose over web APIs. That's probably not the first scenario I would recommend in terms of exposing through the cloud on the internet, just because there's a lot of privacy concerns there. But certainly product information, even a lot of customer or CRM data information that you want your mobile workers to be able to quickly look up in a secure way, I think is something you can do. And so, you know, one of the things I'd recommend would be, you know, look at doing a pilot where you can convince someone to say, hey, we got this app that's working locally. It could be in SharePoint, it could be a custom ASP.NET app, it could be a WinForm or WPF or Silverlight app. You know, let's enable it through a mobile device. And I think the combination of something like ASP.NET MVC with the mobile work that I showed yesterday, combined with a service bus to actually do a secure relay back to your corporate environment, is a pretty easy way to do it. It's relatively cost effective. You can deploy it for you know, less than 100 euros or 150 euros a month in a 99.95% SLA kind of way. And you can work with the existing databases and the existing backend systems that you already have. And you know, one of the things I kind of talked about a little bit in my Azure talk, but something that a lot of people, until you kind of look into it, they don't always understand it on the first time I kind of explain it. But let me just kind of bring up the slide here and I'll show it. But one of the things that's kind of compelling about the service bus, and it's kind of unique with Windows Azure, other cloud providers don't really have it, is this ability so that you can run some code inside Azure and then still reach back to your existing data center to get access to your data. And basically what the service bus allows you to do is you could have this app, this cloud app, be that ASP.NET server app projecting to a phone. And then basically this tunnels back to your corporate environment through a firewall to a WCF service that can talk to your database. And this kind of architecture, the benefit of this architecture is you're not moving your database, which is often the hardest part to move. And from a security perspective, going back to your management's concerns, you're not opening up your firewall to allow arbitrary access to your network. Instead, you're only exposing whatever data you want to expose from that WCF service within your enterprise. And so if you just want to have a simple mobile app that lets you do four things, and not give you access to delete customers or place orders or look at confidential information, you can expose that, those four things from that WCF service, you can connect it to Azure, and then your ASP.NET apps, whether they're projecting HTML, whether they're projecting web APIs, can basically call that service in a very performant way and retrieve and send that data back and forth. And so that's a really easy way to mobile enable your existing solutions. And you can give a lot of immediate return on investment to your enterprise. And like I showed yesterday, that ASP.NET app could expose HTML to mobile devices. It could expose HTML to browsers. It could also expose web APIs through REST and then use WCF on the back end to connect using TCP to your service. And so if you want to build a Windows 8 Metro app that works offline, if you want to build an iOS app or an Android app, whether it's using native languages are using MonoTouch or MonoDroid, you can do that in a really easy way. And again, a very secure way that doesn't cost much money. So that's one scenario I'd recommend if you're trying to get someone to pilot, you know, using Azure and using the cloud, where you can get kind of immediate return on investment with relatively little engineering effort and relatively low cost. The other thing I'd recommend then from convincing, you know, people to try the cloud is also to look at any kind of big data scenario. And I think some people were asking about roadmaps and some of the things that we're looking on investing in more from the Azure perspective. One of the things that we're looking really hard at is this concept we call big data, which is how can you actually store lots and lots of information inside the cloud, but more importantly, how can you extract information and extract value out of that data? And there's kind of an interesting trend right now, which is if you look at the cost of storing data, it's plummeting over the last 10 years, or last 30 years, in fact. You know, the cost of storing, let's say, a megabyte of data, I think it's something like 50,000 times cheaper than it was in the early 1980s. And it's also faster and more reliable and a whole bunch of other benefits. But the interesting thing about the cost coming down and the interesting thing about the cloud providing a lot more CPU power to process that data is that for most organizations, it's now cheap enough to store data that I can almost guarantee that the cost of storing data will make it worthwhile in order to do so because you can extract more than enough value out of it. And when we think about data today, often we think about databases. And when I say big data, I'm not thinking about relational SQL tables. Imagine, you know, notes from this conference. Instead of actually putting them on a bookshelf, do you scan them in as PDFs and do you save them in a storage device? Receipts from business trips, invoices from customers, call logs. You know, how do you save every bit of information that your organization uses or generates in the cloud? And then how do you actually run queries against it so that you can extract information? And you might find insights like, oh, you know, a lot of our employees prefer this type of coffee. Okay, that's the type of coffee we should install in our coffee makers at work. How do you kind of get any unique value out of receipts, out of customer interactions? You know, a lot of this sort of stuff might be unstructured, so it's not stored in tables, it's stored in PDFs. You're using kind of optical character recognition to extract it. But if it costs you pennies to store it, my guess is almost anything you can extract more than that in terms of value over the next 5 years, including questions that you never thought of. And because you can now store it and because you can now process that information in really interesting ways, you just get kind of an awful lot of value out of it. And I think you're going to see a whole science and a whole kind of part of IT emerge, which is basically working with data and getting those kind of unique insights from it. So we're doing lots of stuff on the Azure front, as well as our tools, to kind of provide an easy way that you can actually work against that. You know, I'm going to give a couple of simple examples of kind of like how you can use this to actually, it sounds sort of maybe like rocket science here, but I'll give you a couple examples of how we're doing stuff on my team a little differently in terms of using data in interesting ways. So this is kind of our Azure website. One of the things that we launched this new website in December. Our old one was terrible. And one of the things we tried to do as part of launching it was to sort of say, okay, we're going to put new content, we're going to have a new information architecture, but we're also going to instrument it so that we actually know exactly what causes people to do what when they visit the site. It's called A-B testing, or more precisely, multivariate testing. And so depending on when you hit this site, in fact, if all of you hit the site right now, you'd all probably see subtly different versions of the website when you visit it. Because we basically dynamically change text on the fly to basically control and test to see whether you click something more likely or not, depending on what we actually measure. That's sort of an example of using big data, where you gather lots of information, you mine it, and you get unique insights from it. And I can give you, I'm not really supposed to, but I will, a few insights in terms of just minor things that we learned, which are completely non-obvious. But it turns out when you have the raw data and you can actually run queries against it, you can get these unique insights. So for example, like, let me see. I've got to remember what all is in this data that I'm showing. This is definitely not intended to just show it out in the world. But I'll give you a couple examples. This is an internal deck that we created that was actually just summarizing the first 2 weeks of insight. But basically, we had what's called a control variation. So that was what we shipped in December for the website. And then we basically said, why don't we try two different versions on the website for our sign-up page? This is the website here. And so basically, we said, why don't we try two different versions of the green button? Do we have sign up now? Do we have try it free? Do we have get it now? Any guess what the differences are? To try it free. Basically, you know, the conversion ratios, the try it free actually generates 5,000 more trial activations per week. Just that one text change on the website. you know, other changes in terms of, do you have take the tour, explore the features, learn more on the homepage? You know, it's significantly more if you say explore the features. The one that I found, you know, which order do you have the links on the bottom website? So in other words, if you go to our homepage here, you know, is it scenarios, free trial, develop? Is it develop, free trial, scenarios? Is it free trial, scenarios, develop? Basically, we just randomly changed them and measured which one people actually clicked. And what we found was, you know, you actually get about 4,000 more clicks per day if you actually have it in a certain order. The one that I found that, you know, do we have a tour link or do we have a features link? You know, again, it turns out you get about 5,000 more visitors per week if you name it features instead of tour. The one I thought was the most interesting was case studies. So basically, we have two versions of our website. One that has case studies with big corporate logos on the bottom. So big companies like NASA and Pixar and Boeing and T-Mobile and, you know, lots of corporate giant projects that are built on top of Azure. And you can click them and you can go to a case study. And then we said, we have another version here, which is has no case studies. So in other words, no customers, as far as we tell, can actually use Azure. And so which of the two do you think will actually cause more people to buy Azure? Everyone naturally thinks if you have case studies of important people that have built on Azure, that would probably cause people to want to buy it. And you might even think that more if I told you that you know, they all go to great case studies. It turns out if you actually remove the case studies, more people actually will buy your product, or at least our product, which is completely counterintuitive in terms of expectation. But it turns out our sales go up 10% if we don't tell you that anyone uses it, which is really weird. Well, they're big, they're all billion-dollar companies. But basically, you know, the hypothesis we have is it turns out that if you provide too many choices to people, they get confused and they actually don't click anything. It turns out no one actually clicked the case studies. And what we found was instead what they did is they didn't click anything, whereas if you remove the case studies, more people actually clicked the, you know, take the tour and the buy button. So that's completely non-obvious. And so if you'll notice, if you go to our website today, we no longer have case studies by default. But those are kind of examples, I'd say, of kind of insights you can gather from data. And these are just sort of simple things that we've done over the last 2 weeks in terms of measuring and testing. But if you think about all the things that your organizations do, regardless of size, if you save everything in bits of data, even if it's going back 3 or 4 years, your HTTP log files from your web server, your key card access for your employees, you can basically write a query against it and get statistical data that will probably improve your business 15, 20, 30%. It's not difficult to get, we find, with just subtle tweaks in terms of logic. It's having the data that gives you the knowledge that that actually is causing the right impact that actually dictates whether or not to do it. Question? Yeah, so it's a good question. The question is sort of how do you gather all that information? There's a couple different ways you can do it. For this case here, what we actually do, sometimes there's server frameworks that you can do that actually will measure that. The key thing you want to do every time you're doing any for like what we call A/B testing on sites is you want to be careful that you compare behavior in the same time period. And so a lot of times people will say, oh, I'm going to change the text in the afternoon, and I'll use a different text in the morning. The problem is that's not really an apples to apples comparison, because some people might, you know, it could be the time of the day that's actually indicating whether people are actually doing it or not. And so what we typically do is when we do a test, we make sure that in every minute or every second that we run the test, an equal proportion of people see version A, version B. And so we're always comparing what's called cohorts or time-based so that we know that all the same considerations are there. And then we basically get the data. We actually use a free tool, or not a free tool, it's a public tool on the web, and it costs us about $3,000 a year to buy the license. And then we actually just have some client-side JavaScript that swaps in the different UI, And then we just kind of use a kind of Excel and pivot tables in the back end to actually look at the data. It takes us a couple days to run the test to get enough statistical significant amount of users to vary it. But it's an interesting case of using data to drive your business. And, you know, we spent probably $3,000 investing in the software, and it will probably make us a couple $100 million over the next couple of years in terms of savings. So it's kind of a good return on investment. I'm glad I wrote the check or approved that purchase. And, you know, again, I think you're going to find for a lot of organizations that are looking to the cloud, being able to get those types of insights is going to make a huge difference. Concerns around security are definitely things that people are often worried about with the cloud. How do I know when I actually transfer stuff to the cloud that people can't access it? And it's a valid concern. And in general, I'd say, you know, you should try to be paranoid a little bit around your data and make sure you're doing the right thing. The two bits of kind of information I would share in terms of when people say, but it's not secure in the cloud, is ask, where's your email stored? And, you know, increasingly companies are using cloud-based email solutions. You know, we often use, you know, personally, you know, whether it's Hotmail or Gmail or other email solutions. There's things like Salesforce.com that are storing CRM data. A lot of companies feel very comfortable storing their data in email in a public server, but they're uncomfortable storing their line of business data. And, you know, usually I tell people, think about everything you put in email in your organization. Imagine that was public on the web. That's probably as bad or worse than if your actual line of business app had some data leakage. And so, you know, don't assume that just because your email is on the web but your line of business app isn't, that you're any more secure. You need to be thinking about security with both. We are investing heavily in things like encryption so that you can encrypt things. There are a couple partners out there that do kind of one-way encryption, two-way encryption, but they do it through the firewall, so you can actually set up so within your organization, when you access data or an app, it actually encrypts it at the firewall level so that all the data that leaves your firewall is always encrypted, so what's stored in the public cloud is always encrypted. I think you're going to see a lot of kind of security solutions like that come out. In general, we're very paranoid about security on our side. You should be too. And if you follow best practices, I think you can securely deploy these apps and take advantage of them. And then for stuff that really needs to be locked down or for government or regulatory reasons can't leave your data center, that's where that service bus feature I talked about comes in handy, because you can keep your data in the existing database, in the existing lockdown environment, and then you can expose just the information you need to new apps that run in the cloud. One thing I should also mention on the data management front, which is kind of related a little bit to auto-scaling, one of the services that we announced in the fall that you'll see us also bring up is what's called a managed Hadoop service. How many people have heard of Hadoop? It's a popular open source framework. It supports something called MapReduce as a concept, and basically the idea behind that is, let's say you have log files from years and years and years of web servers, and you want to do kind of A/B analysis to understand where your customers are coming from, what time of day they're visiting, what links they're accessing. The idea behind MapReduce is that you could take terabytes or petabytes of data and split it up into small chunks, and then you can run algorithms on subsets of those chunks to actually get insights, and then you merge it together. And the benefit there is you can do kind of pretty widespread analysis and scale it out very quickly. And one of the things that we're bringing to Azure is what's called a managed Hadoop service. And so the idea is you can just point us at data in whatever format you want, and then you can write a query, whether it's in C#, you can write it in Java, you can write it in JavaScript, you can write it in any language. And then we'll partition it out across hundreds or thousands of servers, have each of those servers look at a subset of the data, and then merge the results back into you. And so a lot of the data tooling that you'll see us come out with Azure won't be you have to write a whole bunch of code yourself. Instead, you can write a simple algorithm, like effectively a function or a method, or you'll be able to use Excel as a pivot table, and you'll be able to actually use hundreds of thousands of servers inside Azure to pour over your data. And that's where I think you really start to unlock the value, because then it's really cheap and easy to get unique insights out of it. And that's kind of related a little bit to auto-scaling. One of the benefits of that is you don't have to set up servers. You don't have to manage those servers. When you run a job, or when someone in your marketing team wants to run a job, we spin up the servers for you, we run the job, and then we can spin them down for you. And that's sort of an example of this question here of auto-scaling. And one of the things you'll see us do inside Azure going forward is support the concept of auto-scaling more within built-in finished services that we have. And then we'll also have the ability so that if you build a line of business app or you build a public-facing website, you can automatically increase or decrease the server capacity of that site based on the actual load and what's actually going on in the servers. In the meantime, one of the things you can do until it's sort of built into the admin tool, so you can just say auto-scale, is if you go to the Develop tab on Windows Azure, you'll notice if you go to the how-to guides, we have a bunch of guides that show you, you know, how to do common things, and you can just sort of copy and paste code to make them work for scenarios. One of the scenarios we have is called auto-scaling. And so if you click on auto-scaling, this shows you actually how to set up the patterns and practices auto-scaling block, which can automatically monitor your applications running inside Azure, and this can automate for you scaling up and scaling down your resources. So if you want to auto-scale today, you can use this block. Going forward, what we'd like to be able to do is just have it be a feature of the admin tool so that you can automatically enable more resources or less resources depending on demand. So sort of those two. Talked a little bit in terms of roadmap for Windows Azure. I mentioned a bunch of things that we're doing. In general, I'd say I think you're going to see the next couple of months a lot of really good stuff come out, or at least that's my hope. I've been kind of working on Windows Azure. I joined May of last year, or June of last year, actually. And so most of the stuff I've been working on hasn't shipped yet. But if you kind of extrapolate when I started and when things usually ship, we're coming up to that point, probably later this spring. And so there's a lot of things that I think you'll see us do with Windows Azure that'll make it even easier to use, broaden the number of workloads you can do with it. And I think from a developer perspective, you'll see a lot of stuff that sort of makes it a no-brainer for anyone using .NET or Visual Studio or other languages for that matter to try out Azure and to be able to get a lot of value for it. So I can't unfortunately go into specifics just yet, but know that there's a lot of stuff coming, I think it will get even more interesting going forward. Question on CLR Sprocs with SQL Azure. So today, how many people here use manage Sprocs inside SQL Server? One person, or two, a couple of people, three or four people. So one of the things you can do today is you can create, I think, user-defined types as well as user-defined functions in Sprocs using C# or VB and host them inside SQL Server. And the benefit there is if you want to write logic that isn't easily expressible inside T-SQL, you can do that, and there's some performance wins for doing that with a bunch of scenarios if you're doing lots of logic on them. We don't yet support CLR Sprocs with SQL Azure, and so SQL Azure is kind of our database in the cloud. Mostly that's because we don't have all the sandboxing isolation pieces to allow arbitrary code, which is what Sprocs with .NET provide you with, in order to lock that down. And so I think it's something we'll enable in the future. We don't unfortunately support it just yet. We are, though, in the new tooling that's coming out as part of the Denali release of SQL Server, within SQL Management Studio, and then also with the Visual Studio 11 dev tools, we are adding support so that if you build a database project or you generate a .SQL file, the tooling will automatically identify for you what will only work inside SQL, what will only work inside SQL Azure, and more importantly, you can target a common subset, which is the features that work in both places. So we are providing tooling that can make it easier because there are a few subtle differences between SQL Azure and SQL Server, which is mostly just the difference between on-premise and shared cloud. But our goal is kind of try to have symmetry wherever possible between the two environments. So I think that will be coming in the future. Someone has the Windows Azure instance genuine copy. Occasionally, if you RDP into your server running inside Azure, it will actually say in the bottom, this is not a genuine copy of Windows, which is very embarrassing. Why is that? I can give you the good reason and the bad reason. Is there a good reason? Don't worry, we actually do license our own software. So it is a genuine copy of Windows. We do have a kind of a tweaked hypervisor that we use inside Windows Azure that provides a few performance benefits. And generally, we take those benefits and we put them into the Hyper-V that ships inside Windows Server. Occasionally, because Windows has some good anti-piracy detection, the fact that we have a hypervisor that does a few extra tricks with the page files causes Windows to flash a message on the desktop that says, hey, this isn't a genuine copy of Windows, activate it. And whenever that happens, we go and fix it. But occasionally, when you RDP in, you will see that message. Going forward, you should see it less and less, and eventually never. Don't worry, your app works fine. It doesn't cause any problems. But it is kind of sometimes a tiny bit embarrassing when people ask. But rest assured, it is a genuine copy of Windows. The Windows Server team and the Windows Azure team actually sit together, so we're not pirating their stuff. We're actually the same team and the same division. Other questions then, because we had 10 minutes left. Some stuff about VS. So the first question was sort of, how do you think about features from VS Ultimate moving to lower versions of Visual Studio? In general, kind of the way we kind of try to approach with Visual Studio, and this is true for most of our products as well, even things like SQL and Windows Server, is we'll often introduce features in some of the higher priced editions if they're kind of enterprise, and then over time, we kind of move them down into the professional or even the free versions of the products as we kind of bring out new features that we then put inside, say, VS Ultimate or VS Premium. And so generally with each release, you'll see a fairly standard kind of model where we open, you know, start features in one SKU, and then we kind of move them down eventually into the free SKU as well. And so you'll see with VS 11 a bunch of things inside the Express editions, which are free, that previously you had to either get Premium or Ultimate in order to take advantage of. I think one of the things that we've showed in the betas is things like unit testing, which is now enabled inside the Express editions. You know, in general, I think you'll see a lot more of those features. At the same time, you're also going to see, and hopefully you saw that in some of the talks that already happened at Tech Days, and you'll see the rest of this week, a bunch of other features move into VS Ultimate for the first time, things like lab management and others, which, you know, so if you are existing VS Ultimate user, you get even more goodies. But if previously you weren't able to buy the VS Ultimate edition, you will get even more features that previously were only available inside Ultimate. A couple other questions in terms of setup projects in Dev 11 and how to handle the setup. It's a good question. So there are setup projects today. They're not actually built by my team, so I have to confess I haven't actually ever used them. But I have actually heard that Dev 11 has changes there. I don't unfortunately know the specifics of the changes. In general, I'd say the question was, are you trying to build a server app or a client app for setup projects? Client app. I think one of the things that we're kind of pointing people at is things like the Wix framework, which you can use with Dev 11 in order to build setup projects. And generally, I think that's where we're investing more in going forward. But what I'd say is if you can send me email, I can hook you up with a team and get a definitive answer. You definitely will continue to be able to build setups with VS. I think it's mostly the specific VS setup project template is the one that we're pulling out. And it's mostly when we do that, we generally look at usage of what people are using, and generally when we pull something out, it's because we're not seeing that many people use it. And so if you send me mail, I can provide some specific guidance around setup projects in the scenario. You will see with server apps, we are investing to try to make deployment a lot easier. One of the things you'll see with the Dev 11 or the VS 11 beta when it comes out, and some of the Azure stuff that's coming out later this spring, is much simpler deployment, specifically for, say, server apps with ASP.NET and with SQL Server. And so yesterday I showed some of the migration work so you can do diffs between your databases. We're integrating that with some of the deployment support with WebDeploy inside VS. So you'll be able to just, if you want to, either right-click on a project or from a command line, you can actually update or deploy your web apps along with SQL in a really easy way and do things like change diffs as part of that for the schema. So we are, you'll see even more focus on that and around setup and deployment because we know that's a pain point today. One thing that a lot of people are increasingly looking at, both for Azure as well as server in general, is automated builds and this kind of concept of continuous delivery and deployment. How many people here use continuous integration or continuous delivery? A lot of people. So if it's a good best practice, especially for team environments, but you can even get benefits in terms of, even if it's just private projects yourself, in terms of getting to a model where every time you check in, you do an automated build, and assuming that build succeeds, you can automate deploying into a production environment or typically a testing environment or staging environment where you can sanity test and then actually flip over and make the app live. And so you will see a bunch of improvements coming out with TFS as well as hosted TFS, which is a version of TFS that runs in the cloud, that will make continuous delivery and deployment a lot better. One thing I will mention that's relatively new in the last week is if you go back to the Azure dev section under .NET, you'll see that there's a continuous delivery common task that's now in the dev center. And if you click that, we do actually now have a tutorial that walks through step by step. What does it take in order to set up continuous delivery and deployment using TFS in Azure? And so there's a few extra steps than we'd like. You'll see actually an update come out this spring that has some built-in tasks for TFS that automate this more. But if you're looking for the exact steps in order to actually automate deployment to Azure, that's now available and you can actually read it. What's nice about Azure and about this kind of model is when you set this up, you can have a TFS server locally. Again, every time you do a check-in, it'll do a build, run your unit tests, and then you can set it up so that if they pass, you can deploy it either to a testing slot inside Azure, so you can do testing, or you can deploy it to what's called a staging slot, which gives you a private URL that you can then hit in the browser, and then you can push a button in the admin tool and switch all live traffic to the staging. So you can fully automate. Or if you want to, instead of pushing a button, you can, if you feel really bold and your unit tests are really good, you can just automatically switch it. But generally, people want to have at least some sanity test and have someone manually push that last button to go live. And anyway, this tutorial gives you kind of a step-by-step guide in terms of how to do it. Yeah, you can, as part of your, you mean in terms of the staging server? Yeah, one of the things you can do if you want to on the staging server, we basically use like a giant GUID so that the URL is kind of unguessable or not easily guessable for the staging slot. If you want to, you can write code inside your app to explicitly lock it down so you can say, even if someone guessed the URL, if they're not coming from, say, this IP address, don't allow them access to the app. So yeah, you can do that. And then when you switch from staging to production, it'll automatically turn off. Quickly wrapping up, Guidance Automation Toolkit in VS 11. This is another one. Send me email. I don't actually know the exact plan, but I can hook you up with a team that owns that and find it out. Codeplex and GitHub, I love them both. We use Codeplex for a lot of our .NET projects. And in general, like you'll see us continue to use Codeplex for a lot of our .NET work that's going out. And there's some significant updates to Codeplex that are planned for later this year that I think will make it even better from a UI and workflow perspective, as well as some of the VS tooling integration. GitHub's also great. And if you go to, say, the Azure website, one of the things you'll notice for each of the dev centers is we do... My network just died. If I did have a network, you'll actually see that there is... a GitHub link for each of the dev centers, and we are actually putting the Azure SDK libraries on GitHub going forward. .NET Micro framework plans. I used to run this team. I don't, unfortunately, anymore, so I don't know the exact specific plans. But for people that don't know the .NET Micro framework, it's a pretty cool framework. It's open source. You can download it, and you can use it in a variety of different scenarios. And basically, it allows you to write C# and .NET code and then compile and run it on embedded chips and embedded devices. This isn't like phones. This is actually like little circuit boards that you can use for a variety of different scenarios. And you can go to Amazon, or you can go to, I think there's a Lego version of it. You can buy boards for a couple dollars and basically write C# apps on them and deploy them, and you can use them for a variety of scenarios. So there's people that have automated their thermostat for their house, and they build a custom thermostat. There's people that have built custom cars that do things. And you can, you know, the idea behind a lot of these microframework apps is they're pretty standard circuit kind of operations. So you could have a light sensor or a heat sensor, and you know, when the heat goes up by a certain amount, you know, control flow inside your app changes and you do something. It's great if you want to teach someone programming. So a lot of students and a lot of I know a lot of people have taught their kids how to program using the .NET Micro framework. And so you know, it's a great framework out there. It is also open source. As far as I know, we're continuing to kind of invest in it and improve it. One thing that I think you are going to see related to the cloud, I kind of added this Internet of Things to it, is as kind of more and more, one of the things that's interesting about these embedded scenarios, and the reason the .NET Micro framework's kind of interesting, is that a lot of these embedded scenarios now support Wi-Fi or Internet access. One of the things that I think you'll see related to the big data comment I made earlier is that you're going to see more and more of these embedded devices that are starting to report and save data in the cloud. China is an interesting example where I think they've got like a $30 billion investment, so that like every mile of the highway, they're now adding logging circuits so they can, you know, look at traffic, they can monitor a whole bunch of data, and then they basically want to be able to use it to kind of optimize workflow and traffic flow. And when you have millions of these types of devices that each cost a couple dollars scattered around your infrastructure, there's a lot of really interesting things around power management, infrastructure, that as you start saving that data, you can do things with. And so generally, I kind of see this, there's a nice connection to this, not only because you can build cool devices, but if you save that data up into Azure and then data mine it, there's a lot of insights you can get from it. Finishing last things here, why am I running this version of Windows that says something about for testing purposes only? I think because I installed it from some internal share in this. I'm not even sure this is a released version of Windows or whether this is like the build before the final release. So that, all of our internal builds, typically we actually stick the build number. This is actually, we increment the build number every day. And so like when I started on Windows, it was like build 800. It's now 7,000, which means I must be getting old. Actually, wait, can we? I'm not that old. That's 21 years. Or maybe 16 years. I am getting old. I can't even remember my own age. I don't actually know why it says testing version. It still works. So hopefully it will still work the rest of this week for my presentations. What did I give my wife for Valentine's Day? I booked this trip because I'm a genius, forgetting that Valentine's Day was yesterday. So I said, oh, guess what? I'm going to be in Belgium. And she said, oh, great. And so the gift I gave her was a day alone with my two young children. We were 3 and 16 months. And she was very excited last night with that gift. No, I also sent flowers. And she did like those. She did like those, I said. She used to work at Microsoft as well, and she's very forgiving of me for things I do. When do I sleep? Not as much as I'd like. Last night, I jet lagged, so I didn't sleep much at all. I do try to sleep. I do my own blog, and so a lot of people often have asked me the last 6 months, like, hey, you're not blogging as much. I hope to blog again more. It's mostly because I'm working pretty hard, and I do need to sleep just a few hours a night, or else I will cease to function. And so I'm hoping as I start to be able to get more sleep, you'll also see more blogging, not because I'm going to blog in my sleep, but because that means that I do have time to blog as well. So what is the fox in the video that we just saw? So apparently there was a fox in the preview video before I started, and the last tile of the... I have no idea what that's related. I'm going to watch it next time, though, because now I'm curious to know myself. It's kind of interesting, the concept videos. The thing I'd say, you know, there's a couple videos, if you watch, and it's only because I've done three or four talks, I've watched the same video three or four times. But you know, some of the concept stuff, I think there's a couple Office Next Generation videos that you've seen. You know, one of the things I think is kind of interesting about the technology business and hopefully the cloud and .NET and all the developer stuff we're talking about this week is kind of what we envision 5 years from now. If you think about tablets, you think about phones, you know, things like the iPhone, I think, is less than 5 years old. And you think about how much technology has changed. Things like Metro is less than 3 years old in terms of design. And, you know, I think it's stuff that looks like science fiction that we see in these videos now, you know, 5 years now is probably going to be reality, and we'll see something even more interesting. So hopefully that's why technology is interesting. And hopefully 10 years from now, when we have the next, the 20-year anniversary of Tech Days, who knows, maybe we won't even be here. We'll just be holograms watching it together in a virtual way. Hopefully I can come back then and see it. So I think with that, we are officially out of time. Hope this was useful. If you have other questions, feel free to send me email. My email address is at the top. And thanks a bunch for coming.